May it please the court. I'm Jeff Summers, representing Bruce Nolte and the other appellants in this second appeal of a business conspiracy claim in a business tort case resulting in an over $6.6 million judgment from the Circuit Court of Richmond. That also bears prejudgment interest from about 2009, so the total now is about $8 million. In an earlier appeal before this court, which we'll refer to as Nolte 1, this court remanded the case back to the Circuit Court for further proceedings on the issue of damages. When we went back to the Circuit Court, the central question for all six assignments of error is, are we back to 2010, or do we account for the passage of time? That's vital because of the need for additional supplemental discovery to account for that passage of time, and it also affects the issue of the expert witness for MTTE, the plaintiff, who in the earlier first trial testified about things that would happen in 2011, 12, and 13. Obviously, the future damages for the tortious interference couldn't be known then. They hadn't happened yet. By the time of the second trial, they had. Now,
is that given the plaintiff a second bite of the apple to allow that, Mr. Summers, though? Because back when they tried the case originally, they had to put on the best evidence they had as to what the damages were going to be. And now you're saying, because of things happened subsequently, we've got some more information we want to give the jury. But is that a second bite of the apple? Are they getting an advantage now because of this? Or the defense, I guess, not the plaintiff, the defense.
The defense. Yes, Your Honor, I understand the point.
You wouldn't want to do it with the plaintiff's side, I wouldn't think. I mean, it wouldn't seem fair on the plaintiff's side, so why is it fair on the defense side?
Perhaps it could be fair to the plaintiff's side. Suppose, in the expert's actual testimony, he speculates that there's 6 to 9 months of delay that causes the damage. He adopts the lower figure.
Let's say it goes through the roof.
Right. But the delay could have killed the product instead of just damaging. Could have killed it. And in that sense, finding out what actually happens is fair to the plaintiff. On the other hand, there could have been things that make sure that the delay from the defendants makes no difference. The product might not have been technologically feasible. It never could have been built. The market might have moved on. Nobody wants it anymore.
I guess my question is, this seems like a real slippery slope. I mean, if we're going to start doing this, it's going to really perhaps change the nature of a lot of complex litigation.
It could, Your Honor. I think maybe it should. We have courts designed to solve real problems, actual problems. They can't duck them. Every trial court has to achieve a solution. It's incumbent.
But why isn't the solution the trial court using good judgment and discretion, like we do in the ED cases, in the support cases, in the custody and visitation? The Court of Appeals deals with this exact issue all the time. And basically the answer is very pragmatic. It is, we may reverse it, send it back down. If things have changed, you know, there's been some breach of relationship between one of the parents and the child, and it's significant, and there's testimony on the fact, then of course the trial judge has discretion. Who would deny him the discretion? But the thing I don't understand about your case is, if I were the trial judge hearing your argument, I would be saying, well, proffer something to me. Tell me that there's, in fact, something that has changed. Or at least claim that you can present evidence that has changed, and then I'll start doing discovery all over again. But I didn't see that in this record.
Your Honor, we did assert that there were items that we thought we would find had discovery been supplemented or reopened. But one of the two companies is in New Jersey. It's Laser Energetics is a New Jersey company, and its facilities are in New Jersey. Without the trial court here reopening or supplementing discovery, what is my good faith basis for going to New Jersey and opening a miscellaneous action to obtain information from Laser Energetics?
That's a fair point, but that's the burden of proffers generally. Everybody that makes a proffer to a court's got to deal with that inhibition, which is, you know, I'm not really sure, but I'm going to give my best presentation of what I think might happen.
The other thing I would highlight about your domestic relations examples, when we have a support obligation in a domestic relations case, We normally are arguing change in circumstances. We know what the change circumstances are. They've happened. Here, we think we have change circumstances. We can't find out for sure. We asked, we were denied. And then I'd like to move on to the second.
Well, counsel, I'd like to ask another question. This is about Mr. Chandler's testimony. There is no transcript from the third trial. I'll call it the third trial. First trial is Nolte 1. Second trial, mistrial. This is the third trial. Okay, that's correct. There is no transcript. Is that right? Let me go back to the first trial. Mr. Chandler, the expert, did testify and was cross-examined on the first day. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. He was, and at that point, the sanctions order had been in effect, and so you couldn't produce evidence about liability. Only at that point, you were cross-examining, and at that point on the first day, could have cross-examined on damages. Is that correct?
No, it's not correct, Your Honor. The sanctions order that had been entered well before the first trial actually says that the defendants could not, and I'm going to look up the language to be precise, that the defendants could not oppose the contentions.
But is it, the record at least reflects that the trial judge on the second day clarified that order with regard, interpreted her own order, and said you may not cross-examine with regard to damages. Is that correct?
That is correct. But by that point, Mr. Chandler was excused and gone. But more importantly...
Well, my question is, he was excused and gone, but however, you had already cross-examined him, correct? And you had not said or objected to questions... Or had been objected, or questions, objections to your questions had not been made on those issues. Is that correct? I mean, if you can show me in the testimony where you were restricted as to your cross-examination with regard to damages, I just couldn't find it in that transcript.
I'd like to answer in segments, if I might. Let me honestly work backwards because I have your last point in my head, and I'd like to answer before I lose it. The sanctions order that the court actually entered said that the defendants could not bring in anything in opposition to the plaintiff's claim. And that sanction order was entered well before the first trial. So the cross-examination on day one of Chandler was restricted by the sanctions order. On the second day, cross-examination was eliminated. But going now to Chandler's testimony, because it's infirm, because it's crippled at the outset, when the trial court allowed prior testimony in by reading it in, all of that error from the first court, all of that limitation of the sanctions order, was repeated word for word. So what we have is a crippled cross-examination by the sanctions order, perpetuated second and third time.
The trial court on the second day of trial on the 10th, in the 2010 case, didn't address opposition with regard to damages until the second day.
That's when it said no cross-examination at all.
It also interpreted the damage aspect versus liability.
I don't recall, but I think I disagree.
Uh-huh.
But going to the aspect of no transcript in the third trial, I'd invite the court's attention to the last order entered on June 23rd of last year. At the end of trial three, there was a motion for attorney's fees that was denied. The court allowed a supplemental motion. When that supplemental motion came in, I appeared and argued that it was untimely, that it was beyond the 21 days. The trial court then entered a suspending order. And we waited. And we waited. And we waited. And in June, we recognized that if our original argument had been correct, that in fact the final order was a March 21 order, that we were going to hit the three-month mark on June 21st, which was a Saturday, meaning we had to have the latest petition filed on Monday the 23rd. We prepared a petition because we anticipated what actually happened. We got the ultimate order removing the suspension, setting the clock on March 21st, and then saying, I was without jurisdiction for the delay, and oh, by the way, your 3 months are up. Had we waited to receive that order, the trial court would have set the clock and immediately run it out in three pages. That's why there's no transcript. We were waiting for a lift of the suspension, and when it came in a way that we were required to file immediately. Now, the words cannot change. Because Chandler testifies by his prior testimony, the testimony in Trial 1 is the same as the testimony in Trial 2 is the testimony in Trial 3. It can be less. Mr. Fisher makes the point in his brief that not every objection was heard by the third court. Granted.
Mr. Fisher made the observation that different objections were made in the third trial.
But not to Chandler's testimony. The basic point that Chandler should not have been allowed to testify by his prior testimony remained. We were overruled beforehand. That order couldn't change. I'm about to hit my three-minute mark. I want to save a little time for rebuttal, but I do want to get to the Chandler issue. MTTE equates inconvenience with outside the jurisdiction with unavailable. This court's jurisprudence says unavailable essentially means dead. They picked the expert. They hired him. They knew where he lived. They knew he was outside the Commonwealth. In essence, they have procured his unavailability. They picked him. Now, we could have gone to, I think it's Pennsylvania where he lives, and deposed him. Weren't allowed to. Therefore, the error of the first court is perpetuated all the way through, and basic questions couldn't be answered because he wasn't there to ask them to. The cross-examination that this court said we should have had on damages can't have happened. With that, I'd like to save my remaining 2.5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
May it please the Court, Hayden Fisher on behalf of MT Technologies, the appellee in this case. Your Honors, on June 12, 2012, almost 3 years ago, this Court affirmed the majority of the trial court's rulings from the first court, but remanded the case for a further proceeding on the issue of the quantum of damages only. The defendant's utilization of this court's remand, including asking only one question on cross-examination of Mr. Trice during the second trial in July 2013, and thereafter conceding that contract claim. The defendants induced no evidence in the third trial, which produced the verdict at issue. The only witness the defendant identified, but did not proffer at the third trial, was Charles Allen, a patent lawyer. And Mr. Allen's patent, his opinion that the court excluded, was that provisional patent applications have no value because there's no guarantee that a patent will ultimately issue.
Counsel, why didn't you present Chandler in person?
We sought leave to call him by his prior testimony because he's outside, beyond the jurisdiction. He could not be subpoenaed.
Isn't the reason you didn't present him is you didn't want him on the stand to be cross-examined by information that may be later available after his first opinion was rendered?
No, Your Honor, because we were making a relevant objection to that. Because his opinion was that there was a 9 to 12 month delay. He said 6 to 9 months. It was 9 to 12 months, and if the court recalls, Mr. Magno was unavailable to perform his services during that period of time, and that's why that period of time was used.
Well, why is Chandler unavailable for trial? Why couldn't you get him to trial?
Chandler was A, beyond the jurisdiction.
Okay, that's not unavailable.
And B, he had changed firms. He's no longer under contract. The contract that, and he said we procured his unavailability. We had a contract with his.
Well, then why didn't the trial court allow the other side to take a Divinesi deposition? Isn't that what normally happens in exactly that situation?
He was with his original firm at the time they took that deposition, and he was under contract. By the time we get to the remand, he's changed firms, and there's no contractual way to enforce his, to contractually required his attendance, and we can't send him a subpoena because it's beyond the jurisdiction. Now, I will address this issue now since
I... Hold up a second, because I don't think you answered Justice Kelsey's question. The question was, why did the court not allow the DeBenny essay deposition?
They never asked for a DeBenny essay deposition, Your Honor. If we go back to this, we sought leave when we thought he might be unavailable. We sought leave to call him by his prior testimony. We were seeking leave just as I'll call them the defendants. The defendants sought leave to amend their witness list that they had filed. They left somebody off their witness list originally. They filed a motion for leave to add someone else to their list. Similarly, we filed a motion for leave because we didn't know if we had that authority. We didn't know if we would be bound by the original witness in the exhibit list. And so we asked for leave to call him by his prior testimony, that being a different mode of presentation. And we had to provide good cause. We provided the court what the reason for seeking the leave
was.
Did
the defendant ever ask the trial court for the opportunity to take a deposition of Mr. Chandler after the remand order?
The only time they would have done that, they never specifically did that. I think
never specifically. Is that your answer?
Yeah. Yes, sir. What they sought was to reopen discovery, all of discovery. And encompassed within that request, I guess, would be a subsequent deposition of Mr. Chandler. But he never asked for a DeBeniesi deposition of Mr. Chandler.
Okay, well, maybe I shouldn't have used the term. Did they ask at any point, Judge, just let me take a deposition of the guy, because things have changed, and if they're going to present the evidence from the prior testimony, give me one shot at a deposition?
Not that I recall. I don't think they did. And I don't believe that's in the record anywhere.
Mr. Fisher, I'd like to talk to you about Mr. Allen and his the fact that he did not appear as expert for the defense. Why shouldn't the judge have used the 2013 designation to determine whether or not to allow Mr. Allen to testify instead of the 2010 designation?
Well, the court considered all bases of his opinion. It considered the 2010 designation and they argued the 2013 designation. And the issue with his testimony was, and the court, and this is important, because one of the assignments, they don't brief this substantive issue, they brief the timeliness issue. And the court considered both the timeliness issue and the substantive issue and granted the motion in limine to exclude
But he considered the timeliness issue based on the 2010 designation. In other words, found that was late, not anything in 2013.
The court never actually found that. The court said, and if you look at the record, the court says, okay, we have to get through the timeliness issue to get to the substantive issue. Mm-hmm. And the court took a recess, considered everything, came back and gave her a ruling.
So she did
consider the substantive issue.
Wasn't the court asking for the 2010 designation because he didn't have it, or she didn't have it, and you all were on your iPads trying to find a copy of it? I don't know that it's even in the record, is it?
I don't know that it's in the record. Obviously, she was considering whatever they provided. It was up to them to provide what they want her to consider. We made the motion that his testimony was A, not timely, if you looked at the 2010 order, but B, more importantly, substantively, his opinion was not admissible because his opinion is plainly, it's false. He said this technology has no value. We'd already been sold to LEI, so obviously it had value.
Well, counsel, how can we make that determination then if the 2010 designation is not in the record? It was one that clearly the trial court was arguing, and you were arguing that was the designation that should be considered, not the 2013 designation.
I'm trying to understand the question.
The 2010, you're arguing that it was the 2010 designation that was considered, right? And the 2013.
She considered whatever they provided. And then now, I thought that she had both of them, but whether she did or didn't, I do remember the record. We both have our iPads out.
But you were arguing that the 2010 designation was late and that it was insufficient. And that because it was late in 2010, it remains late in 2013. Did I mischaracterize your argument?
That was one of our arguments. We also argued, they don't brief this issue, and I think it's important. We also argued the substantive issue. And the substantive issue was that his opinion was unreliable. And that court considered the substantive issue.
But was that from the 2010 designation or the 2013 designation?
Well, we made a motion based on the 2013 designation.
Okay.
Our motion was based on all the designations, and we did argue the time on this issue, but we also argued the we weren't sure if that issue was, frankly, it's a unique situation when you come back on a remand like this. But substantively, we were confident that opinion was not reliable because even if he's qualified, there's a question if he's qualified to value IP as a patent attorney, his opinion was it had no value. Well, it had already been sold to LAI, so it obviously had value. And for that reason, we asked it to be excluded on substantive grounds.
May I ask a follow-up question to Justice Lacey's question? It seems to me that the motion in limine just dealt with the timeliness of the 2010. And I do recall that there was some discussion at the hearing about the substance. But as I recall the testimony, the court was going to take up the timeliness issue. There was some discussion about scheduling the substantive issue for later because it hadn't been noticed for that day. Am I recalling the correct hearing?
I do remember the hearing, and there certainly everything was argued. His opinion, the substance of his opinion was argued. And I think there were multiple designations back in the first trial.
And so when the court makes her ruling, she says, I'm granting the motion in limine. The motion in limine, the one that was in writing, that's in the transcript, only dealt with the timeliness.
Well, but both issues were argued. And we argued the substantive issue as well as the timeliness issue. And we argued all of the opinions. And frankly, I think that they would have had to proffer at trial three, his opinion, for the court to consider it. So we think that there's probably a waiver there because the trial transcript has not been produced. And with respect to why the trial transcript is not
counsel,
produced...
Counsel, can they be blamed because of the way the final order was entered? I mean, the explanation he gave is that he was basically sandbagged inadvertently, to be sure, but that's the way it appeared to them.
Well, the trial was in December of 2013. And the order wasn't until March of 2014. So he had 4 months to get the trial transcript. They knew they were going to need it. They could have emergency ordered it as soon as the order came out. And the order that came out in March was a final order. And then we saw it add the attorney's fees. But that was the final order when it came out. So they were on notice at that point in time that they needed to get the transcript filed. They knew they had to file it. They had 4 months to obtain it and file it before we get to March of 2014. So, and I'll also note they didn't file any kind of motion seeking any type of leave to add that to the record in this case. I believe that's because they didn't make the appropriate objections. When we get back to Chandler and back to this issue of leave, so leave was granted to potentially call him on by his prior testimony. Now, we proffered good cause as to potential availability, and at that point, we weren't sure whether he would be liable by prior testimony. Now, at trial, it's an out-of-court statement, so their objection should be hearsay, at which point we were prepared to prove unavailability to the court. They never made the hearsay objection.
Let me ask a question about Chandler's testimony. The sanction order was entered pre-trial, before the first trial, is that correct?
Correct.
And in the sanction order, they were prohibited from opposing the testimony, from opposing the claims. So by reading Chandler's testimony into the subsequent trials, don't you simply inject the same prejudice that pervaded the first trial with their limitations into the subsequent trial?
No, both the defendants on their brief and this court in its opinion, the problems and the error did not get committed until day two. They had 66 pages of cross-examination.
No, I understand that she completely shut them down on day two. But if I'm understanding the sequencing, the sanction order came down pre-trial sometime in October.
Correct.
The sanction order prohibited them from opposing the claims. And so at a minimum, their cross-examination of Chandler was abbreviated because they couldn't oppose any of the testimony that he was...
That's all that happened at the first trial, Your Honor, and this court affirmed the sanctions order. It was the...
I understand we sustained the sanction order, but my question goes to how Chandler's testimony his cross-examination was limited in the first trial.
His cross-examination was not limited at all. It was the court's interpretation of its own order on day two that limited cross-examination. They were not limited on cross-examination on day two.
So what did the order mean when it said they couldn't oppose the claims alleged?
Well, they could not put up liability evidence. They could not introduce liability evidence. They were restricted to evidence only on the issue of damages. And you have to remember, one of the defendants was in default judgment. So there were two different sanctions rulings. One was they could not oppose the claims, and the other one was a default sanction. So, but the error that occurred that this court found in the first trial happened on day two because they were restricted from cross-examination on day two, not day one, and they argued that in their brief as well, that the problem started on day two. They say on day two, and this court noted that in its original opinion. I only have a few minutes, so I'm going to address the...
What did the defendants get from the big win in the court, in the Supreme Court? What did they get for that win?
They got the opportunity to present evidence if they had any, but they don't have any is the problem.
Well, they were shut down on their new expert, they were shut down on discovery, and they got stuck with the transcript of the plaintiff's original expert. It doesn't seem like they got much out of the win.
Yeah, I would just argue they don't have any, their opinion evidence that they didn't hire a evaluation expert. They hired a lawyer who gave a very unsupportable opinion. And they chose their expert, they designated the opinion they wanted to designate. They could have designated a different expert or a different opinion. So they got, I don't think, frankly, they didn't have any evidence. They don't have any evidence. They couldn't credibly oppose the plaintiff's claims, and I think that's the reason why they ultimately end up being sanctioned in the first place. They had to try and cheat to win, is what they were doing. I want to address really quickly this case law on availability, because the defendants on page 15 cite absence from the jurisdiction as their basis, and they cite the number of cases that deal with absence of the, and that's Ms. Jonesburg Commonwealth lists the seven conditions, they call it, from Professor Friend's evidence book, and now that's number four, but that deals with someone who's a Virginia resident who is absent from the jurisdiction at the time, as opposed to a non-resident who the court does not have jurisdiction over. So I think that is a distinction there. And they make that argument. They are absence, where it should be argument number six. And unless the court has any questions, our time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Simmers, let me ask you. You have not appealed the trial court's order on count five. Is that correct? Count five, the lease?
We didn't appeal it directly. We appealed the estoppel and the assignment of error, I think it's
one.
Three and four.
Yeah, three and four. Well, you didn't appeal it directly, but you never mentioned count five in your brief or anything.
I acknowledge, Your Honor.
Okay. Let me ask you one other question. In your first assignment of error, you argued, and you talked this morning about the supplementing discovery, and you argue about that, but you've not addressed any assignment of error relating to the denial of your motion to provide, to have Chandler supplement his testimony.
I believe I did that in assignment one, Your Honor. That's what that was doing.
You're talking about you didn't, your assignment one says that you were denied the ability to introduce additional evidence.
I'm sorry, did you say Chandler? I may have misheard you.
Yes, I said Chandler.
I'm sorry.
Chandler is number two, isn't it?
Chandler is both two and three.
But in number one, you say you denied response. You denied the ability to add more discovery, and your argument is about the lack of or the denial of your motion to supplement discovery through Chandler.
Had we been able to supplement, had Chandler appeared in person, we would have been able to have an effective cross-examination because he would have been confronted with a prediction versus actuality.
Excuse me, sir. I think I didn't express my question correctly. In number one, you do not address the motion to compel supplement. In number one's argument, that is what you're arguing about. I'm asking you the relationship between the argument put out under assignment of error number one.
Your Honor, I think
without being evasive, I think I was doing that. I may not have done it as well, but I think that's what I was doing. In the 15 seconds I have left, I want to make one final point. Those business years for MTTE are closed. MTTE could have come into that court, thrown down its profit and loss, thrown down its balance sheet, put on the corporate custodian and said, these are the losses. No expert required. They didn't. Why not? Please think about the inferences of that. Thank you for your courtesy and meeting. Good day.
Thank you. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.